Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia? Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found.
Yes, we did. We started to burn many things we found. That was the beautiful, wonderful Dar Williams singing with Pete Seeger and David Burns, the Solartopia song. We're back for another great hour at the Green Power Wellness Show. We've got two amazing guests today to talk about an amazing festival and the world of paganism, spirit, of Mother Earth, of evolution, and of the Higgs boson particle. We're joined by Oberon Zell in California. Oberon, are you with us?
I'm here.
Oh, wonderful. And Jeff Rosenbaum in the lush, liberal city of Cleveland. Jeff?
Yes, I'm here.
All right. So the three of us are just recovering from the annual Starwood Festival, which happened this year once again in southern Ohio. The Starwood Festival is a tremendous gathering of pagan spirits, and since Jeff, you're at the core of it, why don't you tell us a bit about Starwood and why our listeners would be interested and what happened this year?
Well, sure. The Starwood Festival is a 7-day camping event. It takes place in southern Ohio at a campground called Wisteria Event Campground. And it's sort of an interesting combination of different kinds of festivals. There's music there at lunchtime, afternoon, and evening, concerts by a wide variety of different genres of music and artists, sometimes from all over the world. And we also have over 200 classes on all sorts of different subjects, ranging from New Age and magical and spiritual subjects, healing and dance and drumming, lots of drumming at Starwood. And it's an event that we've been doing for 32 years. This was the 32nd Starwood. And we've done it at various places in Ohio and western New York. But right now, this is the third year we've been at our present location.
Okay, so we have hundreds of people there. I've been to about 15 of these. I spoke this weekend by way of disclosure on three topics, on Barack Obama and the likelihood of a stolen election coming up, on the passions of the pot-smoking patriots, and on natural cures for cancer. But I was tremendously impressed, as I always am, with the talk by Oberon Zell, who's our other guest today. Oberon, tell us, what did you tell the Starwood Festival this weekend?
Well, I think you're referring to my presentation on 2012, the Year of the Awakening. And
yeah, let's hear about that.
Sure. Well, we've been hearing all this stuff about the Mayan prophecies and the end of the calendar and all that stuff. And it was interesting that there was a very a terrific guy there, Miguel Segay, who is also a Mayan elder himself. So it was nice for us to be able to kind of bounce things off of each other. But he and the Mayans,
well, nice,
as far as
nice
I know,
know
pretty
we
much
had
are
a Mayan elder in southeastern Ohio. We like that. Mayan elders are in short supply in southeastern Ohio, but this was a good moment to have one there.
It was, and it was great for us to be able to get together and talk about this stuff, you know, because it really was a terrific validation of the premise that I've been talking about, which is something that I've been discussing with people all over the world, magical people, including indigenous elders in various places. I was just in Australia last November talking about this stuff with the Australian Aboriginal elders in the outback there. And
okay, so the stuff,
same thing
the
with
stuff
Miguel.
Being... The stuff being end of the world prophecies for
right.
December, is it 12, 2012?
No, December 21st, winter solstice.
12, 21, 12. Many, many people have said the world will end, but you said a really cool thing. And we're talking with Oberon Zell, by the way, who is a tremendously powerful, shall we describe you as a wizard?
Well, I do. It works.
Okay, you are a wizard. You yes. are the Merlin of Northern California at this point in time, and a tremendously impressive guy. I've heard you speak a number of years over the years. Your books are all over the place. You are the guy who first used the term pagan to describe the rise, part of, at least part of the rising counterculture, which I think is really, really cool.
That's true. Well, I've been around a long time. This year represents 50 years of my direct involvement in this whole movement since I first shared water after reading Strange in a Strange Land in 1962. So, but you were referring to my my presentation, and I imagine that the thing you wanted me to reference was my comment that when they, you know, we all have calendars up on our wall, you know, and every
right.
every December they end because that's the last month. And what we do, we don't burn the house down when the calendar comes to an end. What we do is we take down the calendar and we put up a new one, and we go on. But the neat thing about it is that each calendar is that we get has all been pre-printed. You know, the illustrations have been done and the dates have all been filled in. But when we go get a new one, we can get a brand new one with a whole new images for each month and new dates written in and fill them in as we wish. And this is the wonderful opportunity that we're having now, because this calendar is not just that's concluding at on December 21st, which is winter solstice, and the traditional in the ancient times was the time of the turning of the year at the solstices. There's these points in the year of marked by the sun, the solstices, and the winter solstice on December 21st, and summer solstice about June 21st, and the equinoxes about September 21st for the fall equinox, and spring is the March 21st is the spring equinox, and these are pivot points around which the whole seasonal year rotates, and they're called the first day of winter and spring and summer and fall. So in this particular case, however, it's not just the calendar of this year that's ending. This particular point also concludes the end of an eon that we have called the Age of Aquarius. The Age of Pisces, and it also marks the end and the termination of the huge, long 26,000-year cycle in which the precession of the equinoxes has taken us through all 12 of the signs of the zodiac. And the zodiac is you can just imagine like a big clock face, really, in which the precessional movement of the polar axis, which currently points at Polaris as the North Star, gradually rotates slowly in a great big cycle as the Earth wobbles on its axis through a number of constellations. And a number of pole stars take their turn being, a number of major stars take their turns being the pole star during this turn. And we divide the cycle into 12 equal points, like months or like hours, because we use 12 as an easily divisible factor. The Mayans divided that entire cycle through the what we call the zodiac into only 5 divisions, which they call bactons, and so their eons are a lot longer than ours. So just imagine for the Mayans, they had a clock face or a calendar that only had 5 hours or 5 months, and that we're all talking about the same thing here. And the point of the starting point, the midnight point on the clock, or the New Year's point on the calendar, happens to be the point in which the rising sunrise of the summer the winter solstice, the rising sunrise, occurs at a point that is directly in the center of the galaxy, directly over the great black hole, 30,000 light years away, around which the entire galaxy rotates. And this is the arbitrary starting point of the vast cosmic year that the Mayans call the long count year. And we just call it the whole zodiacal cycle. And so at this point, winter solstice
let me jump in for a minute here.
Sure.
So
sure.
What you're saying essentially, and what I heard you say at the solstice of the Starwood Festival this past weekend,
yes,
is that the coming to a close of the Mayan calendar, which
right.
apparently will be on the winter solstice of this year,
yes.
December 21st, does
yes.
not mean the world is going to end. It
no.
means that you've got to take down that calendar and put up a new calendar.
Right.
And so that phase, that zodiacal cycle has come to an end, and a new calendar will go up. Is it going to, you know, but how different will this new calendar be? Jeff Rosenbaum, can you jump in? Jeff is one of the founders of the Starwood Festival, and you've been dealing with these issues for a long time. You've heard Oberon Zell speak many, many times. What's your take on the solstice coming up?
I must admit that I'm not closing out my bank account or anything like that. You know, and we did have another speaker, a Taino shaman named Miguel Segway, who was speaking about the Mayan calendar and its ending. It's hard to get actual authentic Mayan speakers. You know, you could try to send to Maya for it, but that would be mere illusion.
good one, Jeff.
I did want to throw in just as an aside that Oberon isn't the only one here who has coined phrases. Harvey, you were the one that coined "no nukes."
Right.
So we have two people here who have added to the vernacular for the cause.
Yeah, it's very gratifying. All these big demonstrations in Japan, people walking around with "no nukes." Banners, and I remember being in the farmhouse and typing it out. But
yeah, and if you could just get royalties for it, you know.
Yeah. Well, I do actually. I quell, as they say, when I see these banners and know that we're shutting down the nuclear power industry. Thank God.
Yes,
so,
yeah.
Jeff, will you be staging any kind of Starwood gathering on December 21st to celebrate the change of the calendar?
No, if we did, it would be Winter Star. But there probably will be winter solstice celebrations done by our group and by groups that we work with. I doubt if they're going to cancel them because what would be the point? I find it interesting. But people write calendars to describe the universe rather than the other way around, and as interesting as the Mayan prophecies are, it's not something that I personally take to heart too much.
So Oberon, getting back, you have written, I'm looking at your bio here on Wikipedia. Your original name was Timothy Zell, so the Zell is for sure with you.
That's my patronymic. It's a German-Swiss name that I have inherited for down the line.
But it sounds so pagan. You know, I mean, it's a great name for a guy who's leading a movement like this.
Well, it's particularly nice since it means cell, which is so much of my work is related to the various cellular concepts. So that's nice.
Uh-huh. Now, it says here you added the letter K to your spelling of magic. Why would you have done that? What's the point?
Well, that was actually originated by Aleister Crowley in the early part of the 20th century to distinguish the kind of magic in which we're engaged in actually changing the world in various ways from stage magic, which is the magic of illusion and special effects.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I think that's really cool. I think everybody loves the magic without a K because it's a great show, and we certainly see a lot of it at Starwood in all kinds of different ways, as well as in Las Vegas. But the K takes it to a different kind of level. We're talking about magic that is transformative. I like to use the definition of that kind of magic as probability enhancement. So it's a matter of really shifting the probabilities into a different direction to affect a change that we want to see. And the interesting thing about a time like this we're calling out with the end of the calendar and the beginning of a new eon is that times like that are pivotal because essentially you start them out with a blank slate. There's a new book out called The Shock Doctrine that talks about how major cultural shocks kind of are game changers. It's like they pick up the chessboard and throw all the pieces off and put it down again. And you can, at that point, essentially insert a new template of what the new order is going to be like. And we've seen that in such a classic example with the 9-1-1 effect that has allowed a new template of us being in a perpetual state of terror has been inserted. And people end up just going with that. But we've also seen a new template put in regarding the future. In the 60s, all of the science fiction visions of the future were this nuclear apocalypse and total holocaust. There was no real future beyond that in most everybody's mind, especially in the popular culture. And one of the specific dates that was given for that time, interestingly enough, was done in the movie The Time Machine, where the time traveler lands his machine on August 19th of 1966, and a global nuclear holocaust.
The Time Machine was by H.G. Wells, is that correct?
Right, but the movie was made by George Pell in 1960.
Uh-huh.
So at that time, in 1960, it did not seem at all unreasonable that within 6 years there would be a global nuclear holocaust, and that kind of was a game changer. It's like it's the end of the world. It's the end of the calendar. But instead, in that space, in that blank space that was left after that that prophesied date, a total new future was inserted by Gene Roddenberry, who premiered Star Trek on September 8th of that year.
And now, are you saying that, that Star Trek was influential and powerful enough to really change human consciousness?
I do indeed. So look at all the technology around us and see how much of it is directly derivative from the Star Trek vision, as well as the social changes. I mean, the idea that on the bridge of the starship you have an international crew, including, you know, Russians and a black woman, an African black woman, as an officer on a starship. And this was in 1966. When we were in the middle of the Civil Rights Movement, all the southern states wouldn't even allow Star Trek to be shown on TV. The first interracial kiss ever shown on TV was on Star Trek. You know, our little, the communicators on Star Trek, we all carry them around in our pockets now. You know, so much of it is there's been whole TV documentaries showing how much the future has been shaped by Star Trek.
Huh.
Every Friday and evening even... when the show came on, the NASA would put it up on one of their big monitors at the NASA show, and this inspired the engineers and the technicians in the early days of the space race, when they were still using slide rules to calculate the trajectory of their spacecraft, it inspired them to create a future that looked a lot more like that, and they have.
Jeff, you were about to say, Jeff Rosenbaum, founder of Starwood.
I was just going to say that they didn't even know that one of the bridge crew was also gay at that time.
Oh,
was
that one?
Do we
know who was
Asian.
It?
George Takei.
George Takei, the who played Sulu, the pilot, and
we're talking with Jeff Rosenbaum. Real quickly here, we're talking with Jeff Rosenbaum, a founder of the Starwood Festival, one of the great pagan gatherings in the United States. Just had an incredible weekend in southeastern Ohio, and Oberon Zell, a huge figure in what we call the neo-pagan movement, of New Age consciousness and. Of a great, well, actually, I should not characterize this in the presence of the great founder here, Oberon. Can you tell us, you are the one who began using the term neo-pagan. You have a magazine called The Green Egg, which dates back to 1968, and having been a founder of Liberation News Service, that resonates with me. But you know, you weren't part of the what we call the underground press, but apparently there's some longevity here. Green Egg going since 1968. That's what, 53 years? That's 54.
Yeah.
That's amazing. And you did popularize the term neo-pagan. What do you mean by neo-pagan? What do you mean by this massive social movement, or well, would you characterize it as a social movement? And what's involved here?
Well, I would. I would catch it as a revolutionary cultural movement, really. What we are hearkening back to with the concept of pagan is deeply embedded in all of the more recent religions, especially in the West. The Judeo-Christian Islamic traditions all use the concept of pagan to denigrate, really, the members of the old religion in the ways of that, which is the one that existed before these new religions rose up and took over the world. But what this refers to is, well, universally, the old religion, the more primal, the more primitive, the more earth-based, the more nature-based, the word pagan means of the land, literally. So this is the religions of the land and the people before the monotheistic, prophetic religions rose up and took over, usually by sword and fire and murder and torture and all kinds of brutalities. And but the older ways persist in all of our customs, all of our holidays, all of our folklore, our legends and stories of these older times.
Be a little more specific. I'm going to say also, of course, the neo-pagan, the pagan religion, or is it a religion? You could talk about it. It's a spirituality, I suppose, is also matriarchal, generally.
It is, and I don't like to think of it as a spirituality. I really like to think of it as a religion. Spirituality literally refers to the realm of the spirit, but paganism is very much integrated in the realm of the material world and the cycles of nature. It's also a good term for it is nature religion, and I like the term green religion, which I think is very descriptive. And paganism, in my thinking, is not just a religion, another religion among many. It's really the essence of what religion is. The word religion means relinking, reintegration. It means the same as yoga. And in a very deep sense, the old religion was that which served that purpose. It really relinked it. It did not divide us. It united us among all the world. every peoples everywhere have their pagan roots and traditions and their legends and their customs and such like that. And I can talk with leaders of any indigenous peoples anywhere in the world, really, and the shamans and the medicine people, and we all share the same things in common. We all celebrate a cycle of the seasons. And at the core of all this, is the most universal religious archetype the world has ever known, and that is the archetype of Mother Earth, the Earth Mother. And this is at the core of all pagan religion everywhere. And, of course, this gives naturally a rise to a valuation of women as priestesses. Only pagan religions have priestesses. It validates the concept of all feminine values and things. You said matriarchal, but it's really more matrifocal. It isn't so much rule by the mothers as it is a focus on that maternal lineage and stuff. The Mother Earth, Gaia, Hertha, Pachamama in the Southern Hemisphere is really the mother of all mothers, from which we derive our entire genetic lineage.
And God, I love that term, Pachamama.
It's a nice one. It simply means Earth Mother, really, you know.
Uh-huh. It's a great term. We're talking with Oberon Zell, who coined the phrase neo-pagan or has applied it to social movements, and Jeff Rosenbaum, one of the founders of the Starwood Festival, just occurred this weekend in southeastern Ohio. Oberon, you have this Green Egg magazine. Why is it called Green Egg, and what the hell, what goes in there?
Well, the nice thing about that, everybody always asked about that, and we used to have various little stories that we would tell, but really, in the early days of founding the Church of All Worlds, we became incorporated legally. We were founded in 62, but it took us a few years to get to where we decided to incorporate and become public. And we received our incorporation papers on March 4th of 1968, and we rented out a building to have a public temple and face, and we started a little newsletter to tell people what we were doing. And that newsletter was Green Egg. And the reason it was called Green Egg at that time was it was printed on an old Ditto machine, a spirit duplicator, which came in only a few colors of ink. One was green, one was red, and one was purple. And they had a crappy black that was really more gray. So we decided that we would have three different levels of newsletters, one for the public, and then a more internal one, and then one just among the inner circles. And each of those would be given one of those colors. Green was the obvious color for the more outer newsletter. So that was why it was chosen to be green. And, of course, then immediately related to all green growing things, the egg is something that is a potential. Within an egg is all the potential of whatever life it contains, like a seed. We could have called it the green seed just as well, I suppose. But egg has a really nice thing, and it also associated with a terminology from Heinlein's Stranger in a Strange Land, which is one of many science fiction novels that have inspired us as contemporary mythology and future mythology, the same way we looked on the ancient legends as mythology. And in that one, the concept of I am only an egg means that I am just beginning this, and what I have within me has yet to be unfolded and hatched and brought forth. So it's a nifty word, and everybody seems to like it. And we conceptualize the earth basically in that sense as an egg that who will eventually hatch and release, you know, its hatchlings into the universe.
Yeah,
that's
well,
a nice
and,
word.
And the Beatles said, "I am the Eggman, I am the Walrus, cuckoo, cuckoo."
Well,
right?
Yes.
Jeff Rosenbaum at Starwood, how do you relate to this neo-pagan movement? What is the role of Starwood in the neo-pagan movement?
Well, let me first just throw in a humorous thing, which is that the children's publication that the Church of All Worlds put out to parallel this is called Ham. So,
a reference to Green Eggs and Ham by Dr.
Right.
Seuss, obviously.
Yep.
Now,
yeah, we did it as an acronym for How About Magic, because everybody asked us, hey, where's the ham?
So oh,
said,
that's
okay,
cool.
We can do that.
I like that. That's good.
The Starwood Festival is it's sort of an outreach event and a bridge between different communities who are involved in spiritual pursuits and the exploration of consciousness, the exploration of the wonders of the universe, and of different people's cultures. Neo-paganism, unlike the Abrahamic religions, is one that is much more accepting of people who don't believe the same thing that you do. And the in fact, the Abrahamic religions are sort of unique in the idea that they feel like not only that God has a problem with the people who aren't a member of your religion, but thinks you ought to go out and do something about that. And whereas the neo-pagan religions generally are very accepting of having neighbors that are of a different belief system and think that's a plus rather than a minus, and think that we should compare notes, we should interact with each other, and take advantage of some of the serendipitous discoveries that you have when two different disciplines are compared to each other. So we have people coming from all sorts of cultures, Native American and Eastern philosophies, neo-paganism. We do even have Judeo-Christian classes occasionally when we have somebody who is willing to interact with us. But the Star Wars Festival is sort of a smorgasbord of ideas and spiritualities. And whenever possible, we try to get people who are actually from the cultures that they're teaching about, so that you get the flavor of the culture in a way that you don't when you have, say, white boys teaching African drumming and white boys teaching Eastern philosophy and that sort of thing. We like to have people from those cultures so you get a taste of them and in addition to the things that they're teaching.
All right. It's an authenticity, and Starwood has been an amazing pioneer about bringing in incredible speakers. I mean, you know, people like Timothy Leary and Terrence McKenna and Robert Anton Wilson and of course, you know, Harvey and various other amazing people. Really, the lineup of speakers and presenters is stunning.
I actually saw Tim Leary a couple times there at Starwood. It was really fantastic. And yeah. We're about to take a break here, so I'm going to leave you with a question. And you can answer it after the break. Tim Leary gave a talk, I guess it was about 10 years ago, at Starwood when it was up in New York. And the title of the talk was, What Do Women Want? And
right.
He began by saying, okay, I'm not going to tell you now what women want, but I do know. And then he gave his talk, and at the end, he revealed what women want. And after the break, I will tell you what he said. We've been talking with Oberon Zell, Mr. Neo-Pagan, and Jeff Rosenbaum, my founder of the Starwood Festival. And after this break, we will continue our conversations on our Ring Power and Wellness Show. Yes, indeed. Solartopia is home sweet home for me. That is the great Dana Lyons singing Solartopia. Dana Lyons, of course, of Cows with Guns fame. 2 million views for Cows with Guns on YouTube. Take a look at it. It's really, really cool. We're talking with Oberon Zell, founder or co-founder or name-giver of the Neo-Pagan movement, and Jeff Rosenbaum, co-founder of the Starwood Festival, which just occurred this past weekend in southeastern Ohio in a reclaimed strip mine, a really beautiful, beautiful place, amazingly pristine-looking, given the fact that it used to be one of the great scars in the earth, and because it's like a deep canyon, you hear no traffic noise at Starwood at the Wisteria site in southeastern Ohio. A wonderful place. Before the break, I promised Timothy Leary. I spoke a number of times at Starwood, and I went to hear him and loved every minute of it. And in one of his talks, which was called What Do Women Want, he began by saying that he would reveal. At the end of his talk, if only someone would ask, What Do Women Want? So, of course, he was asked, and Jeff Rosenbaum or Oberon Zell, were either there? Do you remember what he said that women want?
I'll leave that to you, Harvey.
Oberon, do you remember?
Well, I certainly remember his talk, but I don't remember exactly what he said, although I remember that it got a good hoot out of everybody. So if you recall it, please enlighten us.
Yes, Timothy Leary was asked, What do women want? He looked around, and then he said, Everything.
right. There you go. That's right.
I thought it was a great answer, you know, an epic answer. What do women want? Everything. So there you go, guys. We're talking now about we've been talking about the Mayan prophecy, which so many people say means the end of the world, December 21st, 2012. Oberon, you have said that you believe it just really means a change of the calendar, And you in your talk on Sunday, you or Saturday rather, you laid out a bunch of other prophecies and dates. You talked just now about the coming of the show Star Trek. What were some of the other key turning points in history that people thought were kind of the end of the world and really just meant a transformation?
Well, of course, there's always a millennial fever thing at the end of any calendrical millennium, the year 1000, the year 2000. People get all going that the millennium is coming to an end, and therefore that's going to be some kind of a prophetic moment. The Bible has been kind of pulled apart and interpreted and analyzed for eons, from the Torah to up to modern Book of Revelations. I hesitate to use the word scholars, but certainly people who are obsessed about trying to, you know, eke out some kind of a prophetic symbolism and information from that, because they believe it all to be the word of God, you see, of the omnipotent Creator. So they approach it with the same kind of zeal, although perhaps a little less scientific acumen, than do the physicists who try to tease out the origins of the universe, which we need to talk about this Higgs boson thing at some point. But in any case, eking out prophetic dates from the Bible has long been a popular occasion. Bishop Usher was a Catholic bishop who came up with a dating that the universe, that the creation point, had a specific identifiable date, and that was October 22nd, the year 4004 B.C. And there's a occasional statements throughout the Bible that say something to the effect that 1,000 years is a day in the eyes of the Lord, kind of a thing. So this equation of days with millennia is built into there. And since the story of creation in Genesis gives a total of 7 days, 6 days for creation, and on the seventh day God rested, which gives us a Sabbath, and that's what the word means, seventh day. So they figure, well, then we're talking about a cycle of 6,000 years of history that would then end at a particular point on Saturday, sunset on Saturday, basically, to use the traditional Jewish interpretation of the days, and then would begin the 1,000-year millennium age. All of this includes the concept that at the end of the 6,000 years would be this big apocalypse, the end of the world, and then everything would be, that would be the big game changer, and then everything would start over again. All the present world would be erased, and a clean slate would be laid out upon which this new age of God, and the saved, the elect, the chosen people, the 144,000, according to some of the sex, would then be installed to rule over the new earth. And that was a common vision. And of course, that particular date, if the creation date of October 22nd, 4004 BC is to be accepted, as it was written in many, many Bibles, then that ended in 1996, on October 22nd of 1996. And that was a big one. There was a lot of people talking about that. And then there's this guy, Harold Camping.
Was that the rapture, Oberon? Was that one?
Yeah, the rapture. Well, all of the elect would be somehow spirited away to sit up in the heavens and watch down below as all the rest of us are destroyed. And then they would get to be brought back on the cleaned out. And the idea of a nuclear holocaust really appeals to those people. So there's an eagerness, really, for this cataclysmic holocaust, end of the world, you know, apocalypse among these people. And it's kind of scary. Because at various times, some of these kind of people have had their fingers on the button and could easily have initiated that, you know, had they wanted to. So that's one of the very popular
things. We won't mention Mitt Romney here, so we'll pass over that. But go ahead.
No, we won't do that. That's what we won't do. One thing that you did, when you mentioned George Pal and the movie The Time Machine, part of what fired the imagination for an apocalyptic world was the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Absolutely.
Which had taken place shortly before the
movie.
That
was in October of 1962.
Yes, right. But that was 2 years after the movie The Time Machine was put out, which was in 1960.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and, And yet,
well, we were pretty close at that week.
Right.
I gotta say.
And yet, in the movie, you see nuclear weapons having spread across the planet. There actually is a scene in there where an air raid warden is warning the professor that the mushrooms are sprouting, and the mushrooms will be sprouting, and you have to get underground.
Yeah, people take many different kinds of mushrooms. We won't talk about that either.
But what I was really thinking about in terms of the nuclear, of the human missile crisis is how that may have affected the scenario in Star Trek, which in a way was a reaction to these apocalyptic and negative views of the future. Roddenberry put forth one that was positive, where we, and they said this many times in the show, where we outgrew that dangerous time and then went to other planets and other civilizations hoping to non-interfering as possible still be a way to guide them through their dangerous times and hope that they can make it too.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Now,
Star Trek deliberately I'm sorry.
Yeah, go ahead, sorry.
Star Trek deliberately, Roddenberry deliberately approached many of the cultural issues of the time, all kinds of things, really, social issues and racial issues and political issues and all kinds of things, really, religious particularly, in some very interesting ways. Remember the society of the people who were black on one side and white on the other that were, you know, mm-hmm. trying to kill each other down to where there was only two left and they were still after it, you know? It's like the Brobdingnagians, or no, sorry, the Lilliputians, and, you know, opening their eggs on one end and their enemies, opening on the other. It's like the way that religious conflicts have totally wrecked the world is all based on the single premise that is the foundation of monotheism, and that's the idea of one true right and only way, and that everything else that is not along that single linear one true right and only way is wrong and therefore evil and therefore must be eradicated by the true believers. And this is why we've had all these holy wars, an oxymoron if ever there was one, and inquisitions and brutalities and persecutions, and it just goes on and on and on, but it's all done by these people who have this attitude that theirs is the only way, that they are the chosen people, and that anybody else, you know, has to be enslaved or eradicated or converted or something, but can't be allowed to simply exist alongside. And this is a major evil that I feel that the pagan movement is deliberately designed to try to counteract, and a major part of my work in it has been to try to instill this meme and nurture it, and it has. It's been phenomenally successful. The whole pagan movement is predicated on this concept of cherishing diversity and embracing it. And I think that is so wonderful because it's not only religious diversity and cultural diversity, but it gets right down all the way down to the line to, you know, sexual diversity and political diversity and so many little personal, individual, creativity, all of it. And we really need that. We really need that. This unitary, you know, we all have to be exactly the same kind of a vision that is the essence of monotheism really is terribly destructive to the human spirit.
Well, monotheism is a little bit less of a problem when the people who follow it are more isolationist or don't, like the Jews, don't have that component of, and God wants you to do something about other people's beliefs. Jews
well, we'll
aren't,
wonder, but, if,
don't
but
proselytize
really in the very beginning, that, that was, in fact, the essence of the message in the Old Testament books
about the
invasion
of
Canaan.
But the Old Testament was the Old Testament was only meant to be for Jews, and therefore when you tell them
right.
there's only one way, you mean the only one way for them. There was,
exactly.
They weren't ordered to go out and find everybody else and convince them that they're wrong and the Jews are right. Jews, for the most part, don't care if other people believe things differently. They think they're wrong, just like Christians, but
right.
they don't think God expects them to do something about that.
And that's a very good point. It really is. It's really critical. It doesn't really matter what people believe themselves and what systems they feel they should adhere to. It's when they feel that they have to somehow go out and force that on others or else kill them if they won't change that we have a real problem, you know.
Exactly.
We're talking with Jeff Rosenbaum, a founder of the Starwood Festival, a major pagan gathering just happened this weekend in southeastern Ohio, and Oberon Zell, the man who coined the phrase neo-pagan. And also, Oberon, you were an originator of the Gaia thesis. Now, that's generally attributed to James Lovelock, but tell us about your role in pioneering deep ecology and the Gaia thesis.
Well, certainly. The Gaia thesis, in essence, is really quite simple. It's the premise that the entire biosphere of the Earth literally constitutes a single meta-organism, a single vast living creature, biologically on every level, exactly the same way that we as individuals may be considered a single creature. We originate with a single fertilized cell, and then that cell replicates itself and divides and spreads the same DNA and the same protoplasm throughout the trillions of cells that we eventually accumulate as an adult. But that's exactly how life on Earth has emerged, too. All of the DNA of the Earth can now and has been traced back to a single original point source that they call the LUCA, L-U-C-A, which means the last universal common ancestor. And this concept is fairly recent, but in 1970, I had a vision of this that was an astonishing revelatory vision in which strongly affected by various amusing chemicals that I had ingested, I just sort of saw the entire history of evolution as a kind of a vast embryology and linked it directly to my own personal embryology. And I articulated this in a series of articles and lectures and workshops over the next few years. And in 1973, several years later, James Lovelock came up with something very similar, but not identical, that he called the Gaia hypothesis. And unfortunately, he misspelled it because he only heard the word verbally but didn't know how it was spelled. So we now have two different versions of this, of the spelling. The G-A-I-A, which derives from Lovelock's premise, and the G-A-E-A, which is the thread that reaches back to ancient times. And the and Hesiod's Theogony and the term Gaia, or Gay, which is the original Greek, G-E, which gives us the root of all of our words like geology and geography and all the earth sciences. Well, this Lovelock, obviously, because he was a scientist and publishing in scientific journals, got all the public attention. My work was all published in pagan places, in pagan journals, Green Egg and Gnostica News, and pretty much every pagan journal that was out. And I've been giving workshops on presentations on this ever since that. But it has not leaked out into the mundane and scientific community much because, well, somehow, and inexplicably to me, the entire pagan movement continues to remain utterly invisible to the mundane world. But my work is recognized within it because there's documentation of the dates that these things were all published, respectively. So there it is. And, of course, the important part of this implication, really, if the Earth is a single living being, a single living creature, then it must have a soul, a consciousness, a sentience, an awareness. And this is what we call goddess. This is what we mean when we refer to Mother Earth and Mother Nature. And everybody knows this. Every culture throughout the world recognizes and automatically the archetype of Mother Earth, of Mother Nature. I mean, even so much that popular accounts and popular commercials, everything else, refer to Mother Nature and Mother Earth as a reference.
Starting with that margarine commercial back in the, or butter commercial back in the 60s.
Exactly. It's not nice to fool Mother Nature.
It's not nice to fool
But even
Mother
the old
Nature,
right. Disney True Life Adventures would start off by saying, in the fall, Mother Nature paints the leaves with beautiful colors, and you just see it all the time. Today, you'll see news reports, and they'll talk about, well, you know, the Mother Nature has unleashed the holocaust of her tornadoes or wildfires or something, and they'll always refer to Mother Nature.
Or the drought that is killing us now.
Yeah.
We're talking with Oberon Zell and Jeff Rosenbaum, principals in the Starwood Festival that just occurred this past weekend in southeastern Ohio, major pagan gathering, one of the truly big ones, always interesting. Oberon is always one of the featured speakers, and an originator of the Gaia thesis. You also, according to your bio here, are a pioneer in the polyamory movement. Can you tell us about that?
Oh yes, we've been very busy people. one of the things that has been a very significant part of our life is something that we really never made much of a deal about. It was simply polyamory. It's loving more than one person. And we just always figured, having myself grown up with things like Greek mythology and cultural anthropology, that different cultures and different peoples and among the myths, the gods and such like that, that it was not such a big deal to have more than one partner or lover or mate, you know, as you just see that all the time. But in the in the Western tradition, since the Roman times, the rules have been very strict about that. You know, you can only have one man and one woman kind of thing. I mean, even the Old Testament Jewish things about marriage didn't assume that monogamy was the model. The common model that was assumed was that one man would marry as many wives as he could manage, you know, and that was just kind of a given. So for people to reference the Bible as to sanction their you know, limited marriage view as one man, one woman thing is kind of ludicrous, because they can't actually find any quotes to support that.
However, there's nothing in the Old or New Testament that says that one man, one woman, that's the way it's got to be?
Nope.
No, in fact, it says quite the opposite. Abraham has had two wives. Jacob had four wives. Solomon had 1,000. And,
1,000?
1,000 wives. Solomon had 1,000 wives.
That's a lot. I wouldn't try that.
In fact, he was criticized for that. That was a little bit over the top.
A bit much.
But
you
know,
they have a mixer every night and just.
But you got to remember, it's good to be the king.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. That was kind of it.
And wow. But there are so many things that people quote in the Bible that doesn't exist. There's no mention of sodomy in the story of Sodom and Gomorrah.
No, there isn't.
None at all.
You're right.
There is no place in the Bible that it says that abortion is regarded as murder. And in fact, in Talmudic law, it's spelled out quite specifically that it is not considered murder. But you know, people who tend to wave the Bible the most seem to be the people who have read it the least, and they basically listen to what other people have said over and over to them as to what is in the Bible, and they sort of and like Archie Bunker, they sort of mix in a little Shakespeare, a little Poor Richard's Almanac, a few things from just about any other source that sounded biblical to them. Like they say, I'm not going to lend you money because the Bible says neither a borrower nor a lender be. Well, actually, the Bible doesn't say that. The Bible says if he asks for your coat, give him your cloak as well. So
right.
Quite the opposite. So there's just a lot of that kind of assumption that the political ravings of the person who quoted the Bible loudest to you over some radio show is actually telling you the truth about what the Bible says.
Well, it's maddening. You know, we pagans are more familiar with their Bible than the Christians are. It's just crazy. And they've only got one book. We have to read thousands of books just to be able to have a conversation, which we do. But these guys only got one book they have to read, and they don't even read it. You know?
Yeah. Bill Maher recently said that statistics show that 40% of right-wing fundamentalist Christians didn't know that that Judaism was an older religion than Christianity. And he marveled at the fact that there are two books, one called the Old Testament, the other the New Testament, and they couldn't get the order right.
Jeez.
We're talking with Jeff Rosenbaum and Oberon Zell, stars of the Starwood Festival that just occurred in southeastern Ohio. Oberon, tell us a little more about this polyamory thing. I'm sure many of our listeners would be interested.
Oh, sure. Well, the word was coined, actually, by Morning Glory. She had been asked to try to write an article on how to successfully have multiple relationships for the Green Egg in 1990, and which we've been doing all along without really making much of a big deal about it. We got our inspiration from A Stranger in a Strange Land, and it just seemed to work. We just comfortably have multiple relationships, and we just don't do the possessiveness and jealousy thing. It's not like we're somehow morally superior. It's just that we don't accept the premises that underlie those attitudes among people. In Heinlein's Stranger in a Strange Land, the definition of love was given as that condition wherein another person's happiness is essential to your own. And those of us who gravitated to the Church of All Worlds and to a large extent the pagan movement generally tend to feel that that's a good workable definition. And within that context, there is no basis for the possessiveness and the jealousy that you see so endemic in these relationships that are based on insecurity and trying to secure your partner's devotion by putting them, you know, locking them up and putting chains on them. You know, you just don't see that that's what you have to do with love. So she was writing this article called A Bouquet of Lovers, which became famous. You can Google it. There's probably 1,000 versions out there on the net. And And she needed a word to describe this because there wasn't any. I mean, we have the word monogamy to describe a single marriage of one with one other person, and we have polygamy to describe marriage with multiple people. But the gammy part of the thing means marriage, and just to describe multiple lovers, it doesn't necessarily mean you want to marry all of them. So we needed a word that described multiple lovers, and she came up marrying the Greek and Latin, and came up with polyamory, and it just totally caught on like wildfire. And now there's this vast polyamory movement in the whole language and terminology, and it's really it's not anything all that radical. It's about how to have honest, open relationships without any cheating or going behind people's back or lying and stuff like that, which seems like a pretty good idea anyway, no matter how many partners you have. And really the same principles and rules that apply to making polyamory work would apply to any relationship, really. It's just that it's perhaps more necessary in a poly relationship. You really can't get away with any of that crap. So Morning Glory has become sort of, you know, the great grandmother of the polyamory movement, and we have been referred to as the first family of polyamory because we've had, you know, for successive 10-year relationships with you know, one to three other people that we were very closely bonded, lived together with, you know, and did work together, and we're just well known throughout the community. And it was really worked. We never found any downside, no negatives, really. It's all just beautiful.
Yeah, I watched the movie last night with George Clooney called The Descendant, about Hawaii and a family that had property there. But most of the movie was devoted to the fact that this one guy had an affair with his wife. And, you know, I just thought, this is so boring. I mean, God, what's the big deal here?
Yeah.
As Larry Flint said, you know, relax, it's just sex.
Right.
You know,
right.
Larry Flint, my hero, I do write for that scholarly journal, Hustler magazine, from time to time. Yeah. But we wanted to talk also, we're talking with O'Brien Zell and Jeff Rosenbaum, stars of the Starwood Festival, and we just a few minutes left. Maybe if you guys are up for it, we can do another half hour next weekend, because there's so much next week, there's so much to talk about here.
Sure.
The Higgs boson particle.
Yeah. Was
just discovered, or something about it was just discovered.
Let me
read this real quickly.
The field confirmed its existence. It's, you know, they explain in detail that they haven't actually found the particle. What they have found is what they call the footprint of the particle. It's sort of like finding the footprint of Bigfoot, and then is that acceptable to people to have footprints of Bigfoot to therefore confirm the existence of Bigfoot? And people are still debating that. But I'm willing to give them that, because, you know, if this turns out to be the case, in fact, and they found the particle that attributes mass to matter, which is what the Higgs boson is supposed to do, and the implications of what that means as a field of some sort that creates the material universe, it has some really exciting potentials and possibilities and implications.
Well, you know what, Dad? We only got a couple minutes left. If you guys will come back next week at the same time for the first half hour, let's talk about that some more. I just read a very amazing little treatise on noetics, the science of, where prophecy meets science, that indicates that, research indicates that thoughts have mass.
How intriguing.
What a concept. Have you come across that idea?
No, not exactly. So that's intriguing, certainly.
Yes,
the closest I can think to that would be the concept that the universe is the stuff that the universe is made of is consciousness.
That's the basis of really the quantum field and quantum physics, which relates to all this stuff. And we should have a whole show where we can really get into the quantum theory, because it's really very important with all this stuff. It implies universality.
Well, let's do that next week. If you guys have time, we can start talking about quantum physics. I had wanted to do that with the Higgs boson.
Sure, it really opens it up to that. But, you know, one final thing I really need to leave you with here before we go away. You'd asked at the very beginning of this, we were talking about the 2012 December 21st prophecies, and the core thing that I would like to say is that as this transition of this age comes to an end, we are also witnessing the end of what we've called the Age of Pisces, which has been dominated by the Christian era, and the new era that is dawning this December 21st, or as sun rises the next morning on the 22nd, second, is the dawning of the age of Aquarius.
All right, well, with that, we will, Oberon Zell and Jeff Rosenbaum, we'll come back next week. We'll start with the dawning of the age of Aquarius. We'll talk about thoughts having matter and mass, and we'll say goodbye to Pete Seeger and Dar Williams and David Burns with the Solartopia theme song. We'll take this up again a week from today. Thank you so much for being with us.
All right,
and,
thank you for having
much, much more to come.
Great. Good night.
Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia.